And the edit of the year goes to The Magnificent Ambersons. Hey, everyone.
Hey, welcome to Seen and Heard. This is the podcast where two entertainment assistants go through the Sight and Sound Top 100 Greatest Films of All Time list. I'm Greg.
I'm Jackie.
And we're here this week, back on the Sight and Sound list. Again, we are working off the 2012 Sight and Sound list, where this is number...
81.
81. And I believe this is not on the 2022 list.
Tis not.
It was bumped.
I wonder why.
So yeah, we do ping pong. on the list, so we do one from the top and then we do one from the bottom and we work towards the center. So we're at number 81 and there are a bunch of ties for 81, of course, because
we're still on the ties.
Huh? We're on the ties. So it's another number 81 and this is Orson Welles's The Magnificent Ambersons.
And isn't it funny that due to ping pong, we just happened to do a movie that involves snow and we're recording this the week of Christmas?
Yeah. But if you're listening to this, it's actually the new year.
Happy
new
year!
2023. We really wish all of you all the happiness in the world.
Thank you for listening to us. And we hope this year brings you joy and success. And we hope our episodes this year bring you some entertainment and insight.
Enrichment, maybe?
Yeah.
Hi, Jackie.
Hey, I know exactly what you're about to ask me.
What am I going to ask you?
What I've been watching.
No, I don't know where you get that from. I was going to ask you what you thought of Sizzler.
Sizzler? The
yeah.
Steakhouse?
Yeah.
I can safely say I have never been.
Are you kidding?
No. Are you?
I think I've been once. What have you been watching lately, Jackie?
Absolutely nothing. I am in recovery mode still.
From your film, your short film.
Yes, so haven't been able to watch a single thing, but I plan to watch a triad of Christmas movies this week, or Christmas-esque movies this week. Really miss Carol. Hoping to watch that tonight. Shop Around the Corner. It's been like 2 years, so I think it's about time. And then I'm going to try Muppet Christmas Carol.
You have to. You have to. Oh my God. It's my favorite.
Great.
I hope I'm not setting the bar too high, but it has everything you could ever want in a Christmas
You're
film.
You're really setting... You said before we started that it's your favorite Christmas movie.
Yeah.
Like, that is a bold statement.
It's incredible. It's incredible.
But it's Muppets.
Yeah? Wait, what's your point?
I've never been a huge Muppet person. Like, I
really?
Like them, but I've never... Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, really.
You don't love, like, the Muppet movie or Muppets Take Manhattan or...
I was never really into it.
Have you seen them?
Like, as a child. Have never revisited them.
The Muppet movie for a while was, like, one of my, like, top five all-time favorite movies.
At what age?
In my 20s. I had a huge... Right over my bed was the poster for the original Muppet movie from 1979.
Are you
yeah.
serious?
Oh, yeah. I still think it's one of the great films of the 20th century.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Are you kidding?
I can't tell if you're joking.
No, I'm not joking at all. It's incredible.
I like Sesame Street.
Here's the thing. Sesame Street is for kids.
Exactly. So when I was a kid, it was like, I liked Sesame Street.
Of course. I do too. It's amazing. Sesame Street is incredible. But like the Muppets were intended for an adult audience.
No,
like,
they weren't.
Yes. Wait, have you ever seen any of the Muppet Show from the 70s?
No.
Oh, it's on Disney Plus. Check it out. It's literally intended for, you know, a more adult crowd. Not that it's like raunchy, but it's like intended for adults.
Huh.
Yeah.
Anyway, what have you been watching? I don't know why I'm laughing. I'm laughing because I saw you yesterday.
Yes. Yeah, just, you know, a little here and there. I did, I saw Walter Hill's Streets of Fire for the first time, which is sort of a self-proclaimed rock and roll fable from 1984 with Diane Lane and Willem Dafoe and Rick Moranis. It was fun, but like I think I was expecting something a little more from it, but it's still a good time. I rewatched Black Christmas. I showed it to Molly for the first time. And of course, even knowing what the movie was, Molly left like 20 minutes into the movie because she was like, this is not the vibe. So it was just me. I think Black Christmas is the best American slasher movie. I think 1974, Bob Clark, who like 10 years later directed A Christmas Story.
Oh.
But in, you know, 1974, yeah, he made this Christmas slasher film, mm-hmm, which I think is the best slasher. I think Halloween came out in 78, and that gets a lot of credit for kind of being like the first modern slasher movie. Black Christmas is better than Halloween.
Nice.
It's scarier. It's more stylish. I love Halloween, and I love John Carpenter. Don't get me wrong. His style is just so clean and almost like sanitized. Like, I've never been scared by Halloween, ever, mm-hmm, ever. And Black Christmas is genuinely still like kind of unnerving. And I love it. It's a great film. So yeah, that's what I've been watching. Sounds I also saw like Bruce Lee's first movie, The Big Boss, which was a hit and miss. But yeah.
You've been busy.
Watched Eyes Wide Shut.
Nice.
Yeah.
Classic.
Anyway, enough of this frivolity. Let's just get into this week's film, shall we?
We shall.
Shall we go to the ball at the Amberson Estate?
Yes, where there's no such thing as time that is dead, only now time.
Cool. From 1942, this is Orson Welles' The Magnificent Ambersons.
The magnificence of the Ambersons began in 1873. Their splendor lasted throughout all the years that saw their Midland town spread and darken into a city. In that town, in those days, all the women who wore silk or velvet knew all the other women who wore silk or velvet, and everybody knew everybody else's family horse and carriage. The only public conveyance was the streetcar. A lady could whistle to it from an upstairs window, and the car would halt at once and wait for her. While she shut the window, put on her hat and coat, went downstairs, found an umbrella, told the girl what to have for dinner, and came forth from the house. Too slow for us nowadays, because the faster we're carried, the less time we have to spare.
The Magnificent Ambersons was released in 1942. It was written and directed by Orson Welles, based on the novel by Booth Tarkington. Cinematography by Stanley Cortez. Music by no one! Actually, Bernard Herrmann, but he asked for his credit to be removed. So technically, music by no one. How often can we say that?
Alan Smithy.
The plot is centered on the wealthy and grandiose Amberson family of a Midwestern town closely resembling Indianapolis. Starting in the 1870s, the film chronicles the family through around 1910. Isabel Amberson's beau, Eugene Morgan, is a charismatic inventor whom she breaks up with after he drunkenly embarrasses her one night. She marries Wilbur Minifer instead, and they have a son, George. The spoiled and bratty George grows up wreaking havoc on the town. One night at a ball, he meets Lucy, the daughter of Eugene, who's now a widower and who re-enters Isabel's life with the same affection he had for her years before. Complications arise when it becomes obvious that Fanny, George's paternal aunt, has always also loved Eugene. George's father Wilbur dies, and Eugene and Isabel pick up where they left off, much to the chagrin of George. George dislikes Eugene and his involvement in engineering automobiles. Isabel eventually chooses her son instead of her own happiness, and Lucy dumps George because of his lack of ambition. George takes his mother to Europe to forget Eugene, but she grows sick and dies shortly after returning home. George and Aunt Fanny must now fend for themselves after the family estate goes under for an unexplained reason, and they are forced to sell their beloved family headquarters, the Amberson Mansion. George is eventually paralyzed after getting hit by a car, ironic. The kind Eugene and Lucy decide to forgive George and visit him in the hospital, stating that they will continue to care for the remaining Ambersons as the film closes.
Oh, so that's what happens in this movie.
The film stars, I know, right? Actually, a lot happens. The film stars Joseph Cotten as Eugene Morgan, Dolores Costello as Isabel Amberson, Ann Baxter as Lucy, Tim Holt as George, and Agnes Moorehead as Aunt Fanny. It is narrated by Welles himself. This was not the first time Orson Welles had adapted the novel. He performed it as a one-hour radio drama in 1939 on the Campbell Playhouse program with his Mercury Players Company. He played George and the narrator. And the film has a really torrid editing history. So Welles' original cut was 135 minutes long. His editor was Robert Wise, like the Robert Wise of West Side Story.
Kane. He did Kane
did
also.
Kane. Also directed West Side Story and Sound of Music.
And most importantly, The Haunting and Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Oh, yes, of course. How could I forget? So Robert Wise cut a few minutes off the film, off the 135-minute version. However, Welles had given up final cut rights as part of his RKO contract. So while he was in Brazil shooting It's All True, right after he wrapped on this movie, RKO cut 40 minutes of the film and shot a new, happier ending under the direction of Wise, the assistant director, Fred Fleck, and the business manager of the Mercury Players, Jack Moss. So Welles was in Brazil in the first place because of the wartime good neighbor policy. He was asked by the government to make a film in Latin America. So he couldn't very well say, like, and he said this himself. He's like, I couldn't tell, like, Franklin Roosevelt, like, no, I have to go and edit my movie. So there was all this.
But from what I hear, Welles fell in love with Brazil, and they were kind of trying to reach him and trying to bring him back for the edit, at least maybe a little back and forth. And he, like, was incommunicative. So he, like,
wow.
So honestly, I do think we'll talk about it in a second.
The negatives of those 40 minutes that were cut were destroyed. The only.
Do you know how?
No.
They were thrown into the ocean.
Hell yeah. So they're there somewhere. They should do like a Titanic excavation. Yeah. The only surviving version of the rough cut was sent to Welles in Brazil, but it is lost. And apparently a search was planned and funded by TCM. But I don't know what happened. This was 2021. I think it actually, like, they actually sent someone. His name is slipping my mind, but he's some archivist. And
Robert Harris?
Is it?
I don't know.
That was 2021. And as far as I know, there's no news yet. But
someone's out there looking, huh?
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that. I thought it for sure it was like, oh, this is gone forever.
Well, the one rough cut that was sent to him in Brazil. So I don't even know where in Brazil they're looking, but apparently they're looking.
Huh.
In the 1970s, Orson Welles told Peter Bogdanovich that he wanted to reshoot the ending with the surviving actors, but it never happened. There are a few Citizen Kane Easter eggs in this movie. The Indianapolis Daily Inquirer, you know, like the newspaper that shows like automobile accidents on the rise. That is one of the fictional newspapers owned by Kane in Citizen Kane. And there's like there's a little section about the like George's accident. And you can also see a little column called Stage News by none other than Jed Leland.
Oh, my God. I didn't notice that.
Yes. The film was nominated for Best Picture, Best Actress in a Supporting Role for Morehouse, Best Cinematography, Black and White, and Best Art Direction, Interior Decoration, Black and White. And the film was shot in Los Angeles at Sunset Gower Studios. Also shot in Big Bear, San Bernardino National Forest. But the snow scenes, so I don't know what was shot at Big Bear, because the snow scenes were shot at Union Ice Company in downtown LA.
Yeah.
And Welles shot that last walk home himself, handheld, in the streets of Los Angeles, those, quote, slums. the house was constructed like a real house. And it's not on the 2022 list. Maybe I was right about my instinct about incomplete films not being on the list. Maybe this film is just doesn't really make the cut. I don't know. I guess we're about to find out. But those are my specs.
Cool. I think you covered it.
Yeah. So what are your initial thoughts?
So I know I've given you a hard time in the past for calling movies not real movies, like Greed and what was the other one? Day in the Country, yes. The Jean Renoir.
Not real movies.
You've called them not real movies because they've been cut down, or in the case of Greed, is missing like half the film. So you get it in stills. But I argue the difference in something like Greed, yes, half the film is still photos, but you're still getting the full story. You're still getting like, you know what? It's a reconstruction of the film. With Magnificent Ambersons, it's a straight up not a real movie. Okay, look, I've seen this twice now. The first time I saw it was 4 or 5 years ago. I hated it then. I don't know that I necessarily still hate it, but because I recognize this, what could be in those missing 40 minutes. But as a viewing experience, I think this is pretty
drab.
I think it's really frustrating. And I think, yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I think it's boring, if I'm being honest.
You know why it's boring? It's because
people talking in a house like you hate. People sit standing in rooms and talking.
The problem is we don't get to know any of the characters. None. We don't get to care about them.
No.
That's all cut from the film.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with this film, you kind of have to, you either give Orson Welles the benefit of the doubt or you don't.
Yeah.
The first time I saw this, I was like, no, what's here is dramatically bad, which I stand by some of that. But, you know, I mean, look, I think a lot of people consider his work in this film, of what exists of his work, is like an improvement on Citizen Kane in terms of like storytelling and just sort of inventiveness, and I sort of see where they're coming from. But I think this film just inherently isn't great dramatically. Mm-hmm. Like, even missing all this stuff, like, I think Tim Holt, so one of my big problems with this movie is, and on the disc for this, the Criterion disc, there's a bit with Simon Callow, who's great. He's the Reverend Beebe in Room with a View, but he's also an Orson Welles biographer. And he says that starting this film, Orson Welles had each of the actors record their lines, like, on a tape or something. And then while they were shooting the film, he made them mime to their own recordings, which sounds like the shittiest possible way to make a movie. And it's like, I think they eventually dropped that while they were shooting. But what a dumb idea.
Mm-hmm.
I do love that Orson Welles is trying new things here. Obviously, it's a very dark story. And this comes out in the heart of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that...
we don't get the dark ending. We don't get anything.
Yeah, because the ending that's there now was a studio thing. They mandated, like, we're going to shoot this, like, really forced happy ending that is not...
It's horrible.
It's completely out of place.
It's so bad.
But I think the subversive casting of this film really hurts it. So, like, Tim Holt, who plays George, is so bad in this.
So bad. And he's the, like, he's really the, like...
He's the bulk of the film.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the problem is, I think the original review I wrote for this on Letterboxd like 5 years ago was like, who the hell is Tim Holt and why is he like 90% of this movie?
Right.
He's a Western actor. He's primarily known for Westerns. He's in Stagecoach, which was Orson Welles' favorite film.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons he's in this. But he doesn't exude anything that this character should. Like, he's completely the wrong choice.
Very much.
And then
so.
Even down to like Joseph Cotten, you would expect that like Joseph Cotten would fit more into like the other role. I forget the guys. Honestly, I forget everyone's name from this movie because it's all one big blur.
What other guy?
The patriarch of the Ambersons.
The grandpa?
No, who's the other guy with the mustache?
Uncle Jack?
Yeah, I guess the uncle. Like, that's more of a Joseph Cotten role, and the fact that he plays this other guy, like, I feel like there's too much, like, subversive casting happening here, and because of that, none of the characters actually land. Like,
yeah.
And Tim Holt, I can't stress enough, like, how much of a problem he is in this movie.
He totally is.
Like, there's
totally.
He just doesn't fit,
no.
He's just not, he sticks out like a sore thumb.
I agree.
And especially, like, he's with Agnes Moorehead and stuff, and he's out of his league. And I just think that this movie, like, look, we can all sit around and wonder what could have been in those 40 minutes. But I think even what we have here, like, I think this is a big step down from Kane. I get that he's trying to be a little more adventurous and trying new things. He's still young at this point. This came a year after Kane. So what, he's like 25 or 26 years old at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I do think shame on him for, like, falling so in love with Brazil that he kind of forgets about this movie, and they were trying to contact him and he just like wasn't being very, I think he's partially to blame for the butchering of this film, because if he really wanted to, and RKO was like, okay, we're going to cut some stuff out, he could have oversaw that.
He didn't have final cut rights though.
But he's still like, they were reaching out to him for his, like, Robert Wise, like, trying to get him on the phone and stuff, and he like wasn't responding.
Mm.
So he still could have like guided this to a certain extent. Anyway, it's all a big tragedy. I think sitting around and wondering what could have been gets exhausting at a point.
I agree. I think it's time to move on.
I think it's time to move on. I think what we have here is not a good film, not a complete film. It's really abrasive and jarring, and you absolutely feel the missing footage.
Totally, totally. Especially like when it starts turning, when the story starts turning, and you're like, oh, they're losing their house. Why?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
What? Why is the grandpa like, why do we, I mean, it's an interesting like shot, the way that the grandpa like goes senile, but like, what? Why? Why do they lose the house? Why does having a physical, like, what, they lost the deed and so they lost the house?
Yeah, like, things just like happen.
Yeah, and then, she's sick. She's dying, the mom.
Yeah.
What?
I know.
What does she have?
I know.
Like, what?
Believe me, I know. Anyway, let's see your initial thoughts.
Oh my God. Okay, so this movie doesn't really do much for me, if you can't tell already. I had heard that it was an inspiration for Wes Anderson for Royal Tenenbaums. I don't really see it other than the structure of the title, like adjective and family name. And of course, like the house kind of being the nucleus for this family. But in no other way does this have anything to do with Royal Tenenbaums at all, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of weird that people always make that comparison. I think that the opening is really strong.
Yes, I agree.
And I think that's where Wes Anderson gets his only inspo from this movie from. This kind of like these quick bites of information, the fashion, the details about what people wore, how they got around. It was lovely.
Part's incredible.
Yes, I really love the opening. But the film fails to express to me what makes these people so magnificent. It's such a cliche, but it's true. We don't even know what their fortune is. We don't even know how they're rich. There's no sense of legacy or integrity or love. Like, there's nothing to pull me in, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, even at the end when he's saying, like, but you're an Amberson. Like, okay, what the fuck is an Amberson? Tell us. Like, why? It's not enough to say, like, those were the good old times. There were rich people in balls. Like, no, we need to know what this family is, where it came from,
we just know they had the nicest house on
yes,
the block.
Yes, and, that's yeah. it. They had plumbing in their house.
And hot
Great.
And cold water.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
yeah. I feel like if there wasn't this sordid history about the cut, this movie would not even... I don't know.
Well, what blows my mind... Sorry to interrupt you just to
no,
quickly
No, I'm
interject.
Done. Those are my initial thoughts.
What blows my mind is how many people, like... critics and people I follow in Letterboxd that gave this like 5 stars or
I'm
4.5
shocked.
Stars. I'm like, this cut?
I feel nothing. Yeah.
I feel nothing too. I literally feel nothing in this movie. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think the first 5 or 10 minutes are really strong.
Yes.
And you get excited for the movie that this could be.
Especially the ball and the wind and that's really cool. And
then it just devolves into not giving a shit about any fucking person in this movie. And
Agnes Morehouse a little bit.
Things literally just happen. And you're just like, what the fuck? Why the fuck do I care?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just, it's erratic. It's really, it's such an erratic film. Whoever.
But you know what? I think that, okay, I think we have some really interesting like camera stuff. And it's like,
for sure. You
and
can't
that's what makes Orson Welles like feel important and trailblazing. Like that is clear in this movie, at least from this cut. Maybe that's why people love it so much. Like there's some really cool stuff happening with the camera.
Yes.
I can agree with that statement. Like these long sweeping shots showing like the grandeur of the Amberson house, the ball with the wind. I love that part actually, like entering their house.
Yeah. Well, you have those beautiful
people in like,
you have those gothic interiors and you have like people that are like underlit. It's a
yes,
lot of really
the
cool
shadows, the silhouettes like at the door. I love when the dad dies and Joseph Cotton and Ann Baxter come to pay their respects and it's just their shadows approaching the door. I love like the ball, like all of those really long staircase shots, like that go all the way up.
Yes. The
those
crane
are
shots.
Really good. Yeah. And I love those shots. There's a haunted aspect to some of these shots that I really like, almost like a supernatural, like kind of like the empty space in La Ventura, like this big house. Mm-hmm. And like, I really love all of that. I love when like we meet Ann Baxter for the first time, it's like all one shot, like it goes all the way upstairs. Even the carriage ride, like he takes her for not the sled, but he takes her on another carriage ride and the camera is just sitting like on the side of the carriage.
And it's kind of moving distance from the carriage.
Yeah. And
it kind of moves ahead.
That is so fresh for that time. Like carriage scenes, car scenes are so like stilted and like there's a fake background and it's cutting, but this is all one shot, like on the actual carriage, a real carriage that's moving. And I thought that was like really, really cool. The way the mom dies is again that very haunted, like it's like the grandpa and then it's all one quick, he walks out of the frame and then the aunt comes and hugs him and says she loved you. Like that stuff is really cool. The moments after the mom dies where it's the grandpa going senile, like that's really eerie and lovely. But to at what cost? Like, to what avail is my question.
No, exactly. I mean, there's no denying that the movie looks beautiful because almost every one of his films looks beautiful. And yes, he nailed it right out of the gate. Yes. With Kane. Like, yes. Kane is very visually inventive, I think, on our episode of Kane, which was over a year ago now. But wow. I think we spend a lot of time talking about the visual.
Of course.
The aesthetic of the film.
Yes.
Because that's one of its biggest strengths.
This film is very clear in this movie that you have, you know, Orson Welles as a young man doing cool stuff. Like, that is clear. Maybe that's why people love it so much.
But my question is why, when you have so many other Orson Welles movies to get into,
yeah,
like, why hang on to this one?
Yeah.
There's such a mystique, right? Because things that are lost, there's a mystery around them.
That's what I'm saying.
There's
exactly
a lamenting of, like, what could have been. And I think people get wrapped up in that, like, glow. Totally.
Because
it's a tragedy.
I know. And even thinking of, like, the vast spaces, I love when the uncle's saying goodbye to him in the train station and he walks away. That was very Kane to me.
And oh,
that, like,
sure.
Empty train station with the light hitting. And
although
it was great.
My problem, that scene dramatically is pretty,
oh,
it's
my
pretty
God,
bad.
It's so bad. Yeah. Like, what is going on?
Yeah.
What is going on?
I think, see, this is part of my reasoning why I don't think that those 40 minutes, I think the 40 minutes would make it better, but I don't think having those 40 minutes would make this, like, one of the great
films.
No. Because the performances from people and some of the dialogue is a little questionable.
Totally.
Actually, I want to play a clip.
Play it.
So this is Tim Holt saying this to whatever his love interest name. Again, I don't
Baxter.
I don't know. This movie does not engage you at all, and you don't care to learn people's names or, like, who they are. So literally he says this to her as she's, like, leaving, okay?
This is our last walk together, Lucy.
Evidently, if you're going away tomorrow night.
This is the last time I'll see you. Ever. Ever in my life.
Like, are you kidding me?
Like, that scene cracked me up.
Who wrote this dialogue?
So my mom, like, she was wrapping gifts, and then I put this on, and she thought it looked nice, so she sat and watched it with me.
It does look very nice.
Yeah. So she sat and watched it with me. And then that scene, we were dying laughing. Like, laughing. The way Anne Baxter could not give a shit. She's full of smiles, and then, of course, they ruin it with, like, oh, she faints of, like, heartbreak.
Yeah.
But that scene is
Tim Holt's stiff performance.
The stiff performance, hers all smiles, saying, have fun, give your love to my mother. We were cracking up because she hates him. She never liked him.
Yeah.
She literally never liked him.
Yeah.
Not for a split millisecond did she like this man. She said it from the start, how freaking annoying he was and how he had no ambition in life and how she did not like him.
I can't think of, not that Kane, like, look, Orson Welles isn't necessarily, like, the most naturalistic filmmaker. That's not what we look to him for.
Mm-mm.
But who wrote these lines? This is the last time I'll see you ever in my life.
Like, I think this is it. Yeah, she's just like, give me love to my mother.
What the fuck is this? Like, come on. It's just so overwrought and hammy.
Yes, yes. And you know what? George is awful. I get that that's probably the point. But I think the point is also probably to make him just a little likable, which it completely fails.
Yeah.
Like, who would want their main character to be like, there are plenty of instances where you're really not supposed to like the main character at all, but I don't think this is one of them.
Yeah. I just think it really stems from, like, a better actor could have pulled that off with a little more.
Yes. He's laughably annoying.
It's not even that I think Tim Holt is terrible. I think he's just terribly miscast because he's good in other films, but again, he's mostly a Western actor.
Yeah.
And I don't think he made the jump.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, and
it just all feels like pieces from a bigger movie, too. It's
totally.
Just like, you can tell, and it's like, things like that will happen that feel incredibly unearned, where you're just like, wait, what? You didn't earn this emotional moment, because,
not
again, that the stuff that does earn it is cut from the film.
Right,
apparently.
Right.
Apparently. Maybe not. Who knows?
And, you know, there is something interesting about the fact that George, like, if we're actually talking about this very shallow plot, it's something interesting about, like, George being a young man against automobiles, but Eugene, who's the older one, is, like, more progressive. Like, there's something really interesting there, but, like, it just comes down to laziness. Like, mm-hmm. it's just George's like laziness to ever get up off his ass or have things change. And it's like, I don't know. It's not strong enough. No. Like nothing is strong enough.
No. God damn it.
But at least, you know, they were kind of right about cars.
Sure.
Being a step back in civilization.
Sure.
Going to alter war and going to alter peace. I like what he says about man's mind being forever changed because of the automobile.
Yeah. I tune out of this fucking thing. Both times I saw it.
Okay, let's talk about Agnes Moorehead.
Yeah.
So if she wasn't in this movie, I think that it would be actually unwatchable.
Well, you got Joseph Cotton, though.
Yeah, he's okay. Like,
I think the problem with this movie is Orson Welles is so beholden to this Mercury group.
Yeah.
And it's like, I get having like your troupe and it's like, those are your actors and stuff. But like, I don't know. I mean, I guess Tim Holt's not part of that, but like, what a bad addition then to that group.
Who? Tim Holt?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just like this whole Aunt Fanny thing. Like, there is something lovely about the fact that like, there are some good lines about like, oh, like she was nothing but an aunt. Like, imagine like only being an aunt or like something like that. Like, that stuff is like super interesting. But we're just the whole time we're in George's point of view. So we literally don't get anything interesting.
I do think, and I love her, but I do think that water heater scene is pretty awful. It's so hammy. It's so like, it's just too much.
You?
It's too much. It's 11.
I liked it. I was like, finally something interesting.
It's just too big.
No, I liked it actually. Yeah. It's not the magnificent Ambersons. It's the annoying Amberson. The Amberson being George. And his last name isn't even Amberson.
Yeah. Well, no, it is. It's George Amberson, blah, blah, blah.
Minifer,
yeah. Stupid. You know what?
If you're going to make an ensemble family drama, give us more than one character. Like, it's not that hard.
Well, maybe he did. I don't know. I'm sure the other characters get more screen time.
It's not enough.
I bet
in that. It's just not enough.
I bet in that edit they focused more on George. Like, okay, let's take George. Let's zero in on him when maybe the original cut. And again, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt here. Yes. But like, maybe the original cut was more inclusive and more of an ensemble thing. But yes. This movie is ultimately just so hard to talk about because it's not the way it was intended to be seen. So I can't completely throw Orson Welles under the bus. But what's here is incredibly frustrating and incomplete, straight up incomplete. Mm-hmm. I think you called Day in the Country incomplete. I think one works
more. I agree.
As a film.
Yes.
Like, you could see that, not know it's incomplete, yes, and be like, yeah, that's a film.
Yes. Yes. More than this movie. I agree.
But this one is unwatchable. I think. Because here's the thing. Here's the ultimate test. You cannot go into this film, just be like, oh yeah, let's watch this movie. You have to know beforehand, this is butchered. Because otherwise you'd be like, what the fuck is going on here? Yeah. Like, you need that context. But like, this is not how you're supposed to see it.
Yeah. Yeah. And Orson Welles talked a lot about that long walk home. Like, that was like the big moment. And that's like, he was so proud of that. And that was like so important to him.
And it's cut way down. I mean, it's a nice moment.
It's cool.
Moment.
I like the way it's shot. It's very nice. But like, if you don't give us a character to have that character moment,
right?
What is it for?
No, exactly. Was the original end of this film the shot where Tim Holt is like praying at the bed and the camera pulls back? Was that supposed to be the ending? I got that impression. No,
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
I think he was supposed to like be, disabled from his two legs being broken and then die tragically, hopefully.
Oh, it's a really dark movie. I think too,
it could have been darker. Oh, what the fuck is that story she tells about the canoe and the Native American tribe? Like,
I don't even remember
what
that.
The hell is that?
Wait, what? I don't remember.
Okay.
Maybe Ann I was
Baxter
tuning out.
And Joseph Cotton walking. And there's like this dolly pulling back, and she's telling the story about a chief who had to be sent away because he was too violent or harsh or just a bad leader or something. Oh, she's talking about George. Is that what we're trying to take from that? Is that an analogy for George? Because it's a bad one. One, two, you don't even like the guy.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Nicely framed shot though.
It's nicely framed. It's nicely framed.
It's important.
I'm so pissed. I'm so pissed they made her go in that pharmacy and like faint, because that is great comedy. The scene where he's saying goodbye to her is pure comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sucks that they made them, yeah, do that.
I think, you know, I think the difference between this and Kane is that Kane is smooth.
Totally.
Kane unfolds like butter.
Yes.
And again, it's not this movie's fault that it's missing these 40 minutes, because apparently this movie is supposed to be kind of like languidly paced. Apparently, that was the thing. But in this edit, like, it's so abrasive. Like, oh, you literally cannot catch a breath.
It's really confusing, too. Like the dad dies, right? And then he's sitting in the kitchen, next scene, talking to Aunt Fanny, eating strawberry shortcake. And I'm like, when is this? What is this?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Because he's talking about school and how Eugene was on their train with them. But it's like, what?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's
sadly doomed, I think.
I think Orson Welles, too, he's at the point in his career. I mean, he's said in interviews and stuff that the reason that he was able to pull Kane off is that he just didn't know better. Like, literally this young kid coming from radio and theater, just going in and being like, I'm just going to make a movie the way I want to make it, and just doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of Amberson's downfall, mm-hmm. is like, the coming in swinging like a bowl in a china shop and mm-hmm. like, no, this is going to work. Trust me. And I think, I don't know.
Let's talk about the voiced end credits.
I love those.
I love it.
More movies should do that.
I do. I agree.
It's really like, it's formal, but it's like warm and it's like, it's beautiful.
I love how there's like little machinery next to like, oh, and sound by and camera.
This, yeah. And it's like showing the cutting machine.
It's
and
cool.
Like, yeah, it's very, very cool.
I really liked it. And then the microphone at the end, that's like going away.
Because Kane has the end credits are like, a good cast is worth repeating. And it's just like a little clip show of like the person with their name.
That.
But this goes a step further.
Yeah. Because it does all the technical jobs too. I really like it.
No, I like it too. The opening of this film, if you were to just look at the first 10 minutes and you were to look at the end credits, you'd be like, oh my God, this movie's incredible.
Yeah.
Nope. Just kidding.
What's your favorite sight?
Well, hold on. But before Sight and Sound, have we drugged this movie? Have we dragged it enough? I don't know.
I feel bad dragging a movie.
No, I feel bad dragging it just because it's incomplete. And obviously I love Orson Welles, and he would go on to make many more great films after this. A lot of them, which were sometimes withheld or also cut down, like Touch of Evil. But the difference is Touch of Evil, they were able to complete later and mm-hmm. restore to its original form.
Right.
So, he's such an interesting filmmaker. And then obviously was so shunned from the film industry that in the 60s and 70s, he was just making home movies.
Yeah.
He was funding stuff at home and, you know, but still interesting stuff. Yeah. Like The Other Side of the Wind. And there's that film, The Immortal Story. Have you seen that one?
Mm-mm.
That's good. It's like an hour long, but it's like he made it in the 70s or maybe the 60s. But it's just this weird chamber piece that's like an hour long. But it's like, he's so fucking talented.
Yeah, but you know what? I have to be honest. I really, like, I'm sick of Citizen Kane being in the top 10 of every best movie of all time list. I really am.
I know.
I think it's time.
We had a little bit of a disagreement on that one. I think... when we did our episode.
I feel like we both agreed.
I mean, I feel like maybe because it was early on in the show, it was like our second mm-hmm, or third mm-hmm. episode we ever did.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I was swayed a little bit too much, but I still think it's a fucking amazing movie.
It is, but I'm just...
And I think in terms of like how innovative it was at the time and still feels like really fresh, I think it deserves to be like in a top 10. Like, I don't think it should be number one. I think it should be in like a top 20. Like, it belongs in like a top 20.
Sure. I even would take it, as number like 7, 8.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, it's gradually falling. It went from 1 to 2 to now 3.
Oh,
with
no,
the new list.
Not 3.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's an incredible movie. I think the difference between Amberson's and Kane is like night and day.
Totally.
And it's sad to say, you know, but he did go on to make other good and interesting films, which is good. But obviously, the whole rumor is that Hearst ruined him, right? Like,
yeah.
He did Kane, Hearst ruined his career. Actually, Amberson's ruined him. And I don't think he ever quite recovered from having this film butchered the way that it was. And like, you know, I think it like caused a lifetime of self-doubt and yeah, it hurt his career. This movie was pretty instrumental in like his downfall. So
we should have got what's his name? Reverend Beep.
Simon Callow.
We should have gotten him on this episode.
I know. He's on the disc talking about it. Maybe we can bring him on for Room with a View. Reverend Beep. Like, so what was it like to run around with your dick flopping around the swimming scene? I was watching the interview with him last night, and Molly came in. She's like, "We've seen his dick."
I love that.
Also, he seems like such a nice, like,
he really does. He seems lovely.
Like nothing's beneath him. He's like he's in Ace Ventura 2 as like, yes, the villain.
Yes, I love him in that.
Yeah. But he's also like one of
he's in Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. He's also like one of the premier Orson Welles biographers. That's
incredible.
Love that guy.
Yeah, me
he
too.
He seems really unpretentious and like he has a good sense of humor. He's in Four Weddings and a Funeral. He's the funeral.
Yes.
He's the one that dies.
Yes.
He's great. I love him. We can't say enough good things about Simon Callow.
Simon Callow, we love you.
We do love you.
Sight and sound.
Sight. Okay. Well, again, the sight is hard because the movie's stunning visually. My favorite scene is the scene where, again, it's in those first 5 minutes and they're talking about the last great ball that happened at the Amberson house. And it's that push in when the doors open to the house and the wind and the chandelier is blowing. Mm-hmm. That's incredible. It is. Stunning.
It is. Totally.
That's my favorite sight.
That's a great one. That was close for me. I also love the scene where Joseph Cotten and like where Eugene and Isabel are dancing and it's like they like go into the dance and the camera pulls out. That's beautiful. I love that. You know, you talked shit, but really I think that the Agnes Moorehead scene, the water heater. Listen, the way that it's all one shot and then he pulls her up and drags her throughout the whole house all in one take, like that's incredible. She gives like she bears her soul essentially and then like is dragged through this house and is still hysterical saying like it seems like a nice boarding house, like it's like that. I mean, I think that's when my attention was caught. That's when finally I was like, thank you Jesus for giving us something.
And there's 5 minutes left of the movie.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I wish Orson Welles had made a horror movie.
I would have been cool.
I love how gothic and dark. I mean, it's almost like he was meant to make a horror movie.
Yeah, totally. Okay, sound. That's why I pulled up my iPad. I love Hank Baxter.
Yeah.
Just because All About Eve is like one of my like top 10 favorite movies.
No, she's so good. Like, I just can't get enthusiastic about
I mean, I'm not saying she's great in this. Yeah. I just like when I saw her, I'm like, oh, yay. Like, I didn't know.
Yeah.
And then I got really happy.
Yeah. Why don't you go first with sound?
Okay, my favorite sound is when Isabel tells her son that her and Eugene are in love and that essentially she wants to marry him and that she's always loved him and that he's always loved her. And this is what George says.
But you're my mother.
That is his response to her saying that he loves me. And his idiotic response is, but you're my mother, to the fact that like what that made me laugh. Like I laughed out loud. That's such an asshole, like stupid thing to say. Like it's just ridiculous. It's just
and of course,
really ridiculous.
You've got that world class delivery by Mr. Tim Holtz.
Yeah, and you know what? The music, the composer Bernard Herrmann, he literally, like after the movie was butchered, said, I do not like I'm going to sue you if you put my name on this movie.
Yeah,
he was ahead of the curve. He was like us, he knew.
Oh, for sure. He was crusty. He also did Kane for Wells and obviously went on to do all the Hitchcock films, but
just interesting. So that's my favorite sound just because I think it encompasses how ridiculous this movie is.
I almost picked a sound that was like, again, indicative of how bad the movie is. I feel bad, like totally trashing this movie.
I really don't care.
No, mine is early on when they're starting the car, they're like cranking the engine. Yes. And the score, Bernard Herrmann's score, is kind of like this music box-esque like sound. Yes. To it. I love that.
Is this when they go on the sleigh ride?
It's like just before. Here, I'll play a clip. It's just my, it's, I like the whimsy of the score there.
It's lovely. But no mother would love this son. There's no way.
What are you talking about?
I don't know. You know when they say like a face only a mother could love?
Yeah.
A personality only a mother could love? I think even this personality is too much. I don't think any mother could love this.
Oh boy. I hope none of the family of Tim Holt is listening right now.
I really hope so as well.
Look, he's great in other things. Other things. Again, just miscast. Stagecoach is a masterpiece, all right?
I love Stagecoach.
Pauline?
Yeah.
Okay, Pauline
Kael.
Please
tell me she ripped it apart.
I have bad news for you.
Are you serious?
Okay, get ready. So this is what Pauline Kael has to say. Orson Welles' second film has greater depth than Citizen Kane, though it doesn't have the driving force that might have held it together. Working from the Booth Tarkington novel, Welles achieved some great sequences of family life, intense, harrowing squabbles. Tim plays the arrogant, mother-fixated son who falls from the American aristocracy to the working class. Dolores Costello, the fragile blonde beauty of the silent era, is his soft, yielding mother. And as the nervous, bitter, hysterical spinster aunt, Agnes Moorehead is uncannily powerful in a hyper-realistic way.
I agree. I like Agnes Moorehead in this. I know you think it's kind of bloated. That like,
I mostly thing, but... like her. Pauline says it's a classic performance.
I think that it really did floor me. I was shocked.
And then she says the film wasn't completed in the form that Welles originally intended, and there are pictorial effects that seem scaled for a much fuller work, but even in this truncated form, it's amazing and memorable. Pauline, what the fuck?
Pauline,
it's jerky as hell, girl.
What the?
It is jerky. It is erratic.
Couldn't have said it better myself. That's really surprising. This girl, really, Pauline is such a firecracker. You and like, I don't know. She's just so unpredictable. She's a wild card.
She's a wild card. We've also had two raves from Pauline back to back because she loves La Ventura also.
That's good.
So, yeah, interesting.
She was right about that one.
Letterboxed.
Yes. 3.5 stars. I wrote the script and directed it. My name is Orson Welles. This is a Mercury production. The most heartbreaking line in the film.
Hey, it's kind of his fault. 3 stars. Half a movie at best. The characters, the story, conflicts, drama, all truncated to the point of being almost inoperable. How the studio ever thought this was good enough will forever remain the biggest mystery surrounding this film. Even Welles' visual style is reserved at times, parking the camera in one spot as actors talk to each other for minutes on end. There's very little that actually happens in this movie, and I struggle to even see how it could have worked if the missing hour was added. It's more like the mildly interesting Ambersons. But those ending credits, divine.
Yes! 2.5 stars. Agnes Moorehead screams sobbing because she only has $28 to her name is a little too relatable, if you ask me.
1 star. I'm not sure if I should even be logging this since I was half asleep most of the time and couldn't tell you a single plot point or character name. I guess I'll just leave it unrated. Yeah, I honestly, besides George, I can't tell you any of the names.
I know everyone's name.
And I can't even tell you most of the plot points. It's just, it whizzes by you like a car accident. And you're like, wait, what just happened? That's the movie.
1 star. Ass.
Just ass.
That's it.
Someone gave it 4.5. And they said, my favorite genre is rich people walking around gigantic gothic mansions in black and white as the world crumbles around them.
Like La Ventura.
Gonna have to agree with Molly Haskell on this one. While the lost scenes would have been fascinating, I don't know if it would have been the revelation we've all built up in our minds.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's all I got.
Yeah. Same. I'm kind of exhausted of talking about this movie.
Me too. I can't wait to never see it again. Are we being really mean?
No, it sucks.
Good.
I'll just watch another Orson Welles movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what are we doing next week?
Next week, we're going back to your fave, your mainstay, your main beau, Jean-Luc Picard.
Yay.
No. Yeah. We're going back to Godard for Contempt. Is that yes. Le Maprice?
Yeah.
Okay. Contempt, which I've never seen.
I think you're really going to like it. Like, I think it's going to be your Godard movie.
Right now, it's Vive Sa Vie.
Mine is Vive Sa Vie as well, but I think you in particular will really like Contempt. Mm. I love
Wait, why do you say that? I'm curious.
It's like, it's almost L'Avventure-y a little bit. Oh, okay. Just I don't want to get like crucified for saying that. It's like just tiny bit.
Too late. You've already been crucified.
Damn.
So yeah, we're doing Contempt next week. Come back. It's going to be a great one. Until then, I'm Greg.
I'm Jackie.
And we'll see you next time.
Oh my God, I can't wait to see if you're going to like it. I'm actually really nervous now. I've said that on the podcast now that I think you're going to like it. So well, now I can't.
It's written in stone.
Damn. Okay. Bye.
Seen and Heard is an official podcast of the Arroyo Film Club, featuring Greg Kleinschmidt and Jacqueline Postagian. Theme music by Andrew Cox. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. If you have any questions, comments, or you just want to say hi, email us hello@seenandheardpod.com or visit our website, www.seenandheardpod.com.